Good morning. Please be seated. The first matter is Ingram Cauchy and Stepp. Party's ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal?
4 minutes, okay.
May it please the court, Patricia Novotny on behalf of Alexa Ingram Cauchy. At one point in his testimony, Mr. Stout testified, and this is at RP 508, that Alexa is a good parent. She loves the kids. I love the kids. That's easy. And that's one of our main points here, is that this should have been easy, or at least a lot easier, a lot less invasive, a lot less critical of Alexa. Instead, the court here, the trial court, fixated on the parenting evaluator's concern about what she called mother's powerful influence, which the father could counterbalance. Now, maybe a psychologist has as a dream this kind of rebalancing process, but our law has an aversion to it, an aversion to micromanaging families pre- and post-divorce.
Well, let's talk about relocation, because that's what we're talking about here. And so it's an abuse of discretion standard.
It's an abuse of discretion standard in some respects. It's not discretionary for the trial court to ignore the presumption or the standard of detriment.
So here the record's clear that both the trial court and Dr. Wheeler accurately set forth not only the factors to be considered in relocation, but the presumption.
They recited those words. They did not implement them. And I think that's an important distinction here.
And so how did they not implement them?
Well, for example, in Horner, the Supreme Court reminded us that what the presumption means, how you give effect to it, is that you pay particular importance to the relocating parents' interests and circumstances. And yet, as you go through factor by factor, you see here the trial court tipping the scales in exactly the opposite direction, focusing again and again. In fact, I didn't count them, but at least half of the factors turn on the trial court's fighting the fact that mom needs to move. She can commute. She can continue doing what she's done before. Even the finances and logistics factor, which, you know, obviously is so plainly favors relocation, the court found against relocation. You know, those factors, in fact, there's a footnote in Horner that talks about, I think it's footnote 10. This factoid jumped into my brain, but I think it's five of those factors the court noted focus particularly on the relocating parents' interests. And yet, where do we see in the court's analysis here that kind of concern for Alexa?
Well, the court does talk about the good faith basis for Alexa to move to California. The court does address that and does address Alexa's testimony about why she needs to. So why isn't that enough?
Well, that's just one factor, right? There's the good faith factor, and in that factor the court finds against the mother.
Well, no, the court found she acted in good faith.
Yeah, but found the factor weighed against her because of her quote-unquote bad faith in the timing. That is, the court accused her of bad faith for simply filing the action when the need for her to relocate became acute. Though she accused her of taking advantage of the fact that she continued to be the primary parent, as she had been for the 7 and 11 years.
But don't we have to defer to the trial court's determination of credibility? And so the court clearly was troubled by the timing, because it was shortly before the arrangement was supposed to move to 50-50, which would have eliminated the rebuttable presumption. So don't we have to defer to the trial court's determination on credibility?
Well, I'm not sure that's a credibility determination. And I on that particular factor, I agree that's a little bit harder. I do think it's ambiguous. How can you have good faith and bad faith? That's what the court said. Her reasons to move are obviously in good faith. I think the court there applied the difference between a because of and an in spite of, right? So because she had to move because of the changes, the radical changes in her work. And the court said, so there's also this timing issue. In spite of the fact these arose now, I'm going to blame that on you. And since when in litigation is it bad faith to simply act when you have a right to act?
So that takes us to the argument that the court did not properly apply the Burnett factors. Whether, A, the court did or didn't, and, B, whether it was harmless, as argued by the respondent.
Well, to the extent that the trial court, I mean, I think the record shows that the court did not go through the factors.
It went through some of them.
Some of them, right. It skipped at least one. I think I argued that it skipped two. At least it didn't do the willfulness or the alternative lesser sanctions, for example. There just wasn't any reason that they couldn't have accommodated Mr. Bahar. That wasn't a lesser sanction. That was they could have fined her or any kind of prejudice that they could have.
So why wasn't it harmless? You know, our Supreme Court engaged in harmless error analysis with Jones.
Well, the trial court itself repeatedly pinpointed the lack of a board mandate, right? And I think when you get back to, but one of these 10 factors that matters, or 9 factors, as it turns out, that matters here, the good faith one, where, you know, maybe that's the closest call there is, that certainly must have weighed into the bad faith calculation, too. A board mandate, you move now or else, certainly, you know, influences the timing, right? She doesn't have another year to wait.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Shelby Lemel of Masters Law Group on behalf of the respondent, Steve Stout. Make a couple of quick points on the relocation and then turn to the Burnett issue and attorney fees. I'd ask this court to affirm the order denying relocation, to hold that the Burnett findings are sufficient, but also that any error is harmless, and also to affirm the attorney fee award. On relocation, as noted by the court already, this court, trial court, heard copious testimony about all of the relocation factors, including 2 reports from the parenting evaluator, who also testified as to each relevant relocation factor, and entered detailed findings in writing on all of the relocation factors. Those findings are plainly supported by sufficient evidence, and I'd ask the court to affirm.
Well, I'm not so sure that the parenting evaluator really did consider the all of the elements that in the way that they're supposed to be considered. And the one that I think is particularly problematic is the third factor, which discusses whether disrupting the contact between the child and the person with whom the child resides a majority of the time would be more detrimental to the child than disrupting contact between the child and the person objecting to the relocation. The parenting evaluator looked at that and said that neither of those alternatives would be in the best interest of the child, and then made recommendations based on that analysis. That analysis is forbidden by the statute. The legislature presumes that the parent will relocate, which is why that factor is phrased in that way. The parent who's going to relocate is to evaluate it, you're supposed to assume they're gone.
Yes.
You don't get to come in and say, neither of these things will work, so therefore this thing can't happen. That's a choice that the legislature made when it passed this act. That method of analysis seems to seep through the entirety of this evaluator's evaluation.
And both McNaught and Horner provide that the children's best interests are still relevant in any relocation.
But they're not relevant in that way. That testimony shouldn't even have been allowed. For someone to come in and say that I'm supposed to make a recommendation whether it's better for the children to be deprived of the companionship of the mother who will relocate, mm-hmm, or the father who will stay in Briar. Those are the 2 choices. She's supposed to make a determination as to which of those is best.
And she does.
And her determination was neither serves their best interests, neither can work. And then she goes on from there. And that's a predicate that isn't recognized as a possibility under the statute.
Her testimony, and pointing specifically to Report of Proceedings 134 and 35 and 147-48, and her report at 66, 16, and 18, absolutely opines that they have a strong relationship with their mother, but that cannot be used to relocate them, because the strength of that relationship is also indicative of a narrative that the mother has instilled in the children, that their father's parenting is bad because it is different than hers. And that is a narrative that has gotten worse in the past 3 years since the dissolution. And it's precisely why the parenting evaluator testifies that the relocation would be detrimental to these children, so much so that that detriment outweighs any benefit in the intended relocation. It is because of that narrative, and that is the narrative that the mother has continued to ignore throughout this proceeding and ignores today. She asked this court to focus on the strength of her emotional connection with the children, ignoring that that connection has a weakness in it as well. And it is that dynamic that she has instilled in her kids, that their father is incapable of taking care of them.
Why did the trial court discuss with the mother her failure to attempt a 50-50 move to California, half the time down there and half the time up here?
Because
if the statute was being applied in the way it was intended by the legislature to be applied, why was the trial court even discussing such a thing? Because such a result is not envisioned by the statute.
Because it goes to her bad faith and to a prior agreement, which are two factors under the relocation statute. What the court cannot do is ask whether she will stay here if a relocation is denied, and the court didn't. What the court said is, you, mother, agreed to move to a 50-50 schedule a year from now, and you're unwilling to even try it. And that agreement was entered precisely to avoid this circumstance, because father was afraid that she would try to move to California, and entered an agreement preventing her from doing so until they move to a 50-50 plan. The court is absolutely required to consider her good faith in moving to California, and did so. And there's nothing wrong with the court saying, should you have at least tried precisely what you agreed to? And does the fact that you were unwilling to do that indicate bad faith, that you're going back on the agreement that you reached with your spouse? There's nothing that prevents a trial court from doing that. The court applied each of these factors. It didn't run afoul of McNaught. All McNaught holds is that the burden that the party opposing relocation has to carry is a burden that exists at the outset of the case and carries through the end of the case as well. As to each of these factors, the court found that 9 were applicable, 7 disfavor relocation, and 1 strongly. This is a balancing test that was rearticulated by this court in McNaught and is the same articulation as our Supreme Court had in Horner. It's not one factor. It is a balancing test. It absolutely, under both those decisions, takes into consideration the children's best interest as well as the interest of the relocating person. The court plainly did that here.
Where in the findings does the court take into account the interests of the relocating parent?
For example, holds that she has very good reasons, and this is, I believe, in factor 7 and 5, very good reasons for wanting to relocate. Also holds that California would be a great place for the kids, and that factor tips in favor of relocation for the kids and for the relocating party. The court finds that she has good faith reasons for wanting to relocate, and I'm going to turn to Burnett because this issue has to do with the Burnett analysis as well. There is a finding of good faith on the desire to relocate, and the court enters a finding that mother has very good reasons for wanting to move to California. No doubt, the court says, has the board pressured her to move. Also says there isn't a mandate. They're not telling her
she has to. No, the court says there's no evidence of a mandate.
Yeah, no evidence of a board mandate.
So that takes you to the exclusion of the witness.
And I would ask the court to look at the offer of proof starting at reported proceedings 937. The offer of proof does not indicate that Mr. Behar would have said that there's a board mandate. His testimony is cumulative because he was going to say exactly the same thing as Baumer and Mr. Couchy, both board members. All three witnesses used language like necessary, critical, it's important that she's here, it's non-negotiable that she's here. None of them said, the two that were allowed and the witness that was excluded, Mr. Behar, that the board has mandated that she
be in California. What does it mean when it's non-negotiable if it's not a mandate?
Your Honor, those were the two witnesses that were permitted.
No, but if there's a non-negotiable, if there's a non-negotiable requirement, isn't that a mandate?
The board has never said that she has to move to California.
If it's a non-negotiable requirement, isn't that a mandate? You're the one that just told me that the witness said it was non-negotiable. Non-negotiable sounds like you can't negotiate it.
They discussed it as being necessary and not a negotiating point. They did not say, we've demanded that mom move to California under consequence of losing her job.
So non-negotiable means we can't talk about it, but we might acquiesce?
But, Your Honor, she's an owner of the company. No one has said they can make her move down there or that they told her she has to move down there.
Well, what does non-negotiable mean when, in terms of the trial court's finding? What meaning did the trial court give to the testimony that, that relocation was non-negotiable?
That they want her there. And they haven't challenged that that finding is wrong based on the testimony that came in. What they're challenging is that the excluded witness would have said there's a mandate and the offer of proof doesn't sustain that. Now, to ask the court to hold that the Burnett findings are adequate, the trial court does address willfulness. This witness was not put on the witness disclosure. Does address prejudice. He was disclosed.
What was the finding of willfulness? That's a finding.
That he's not on the witness disclosure.
Okay. And what was the finding of willfulness?
That they didn't put him on the witness disclosure.
No, that's a fact. What's the finding of willfulness?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has refused to define willfulness so far, but intentionally
leaving. Well, but what it has told us that noncompliance with a rule in and of itself cannot be construed as willful when we're dealing with,
but they
when we're dealing with this analysis.
The finding is that this witness was left off the disclosure when other board members were put on the witness
and where
disclosure.
Was the finding of willfulness? Those are just simply findings of facts that are not compliance with the rule.
And if you're not comfortable with that under Burnett, then I'd ask you to hold that the error is harmless under Jones v. City of Seattle, with the exact same fact pattern where witnesses were also excluded because testimony was cumulative or for other evidentiary reasons. Mr. Behar's testimony is cumulative of Mr. Baumer's and Mr. Couchy's testimony. And again, I'd refer the court to the offer of proof and the testimony of those two witnesses. And I think the Supreme Court has dictated that analysis applies in these cases, and I would ask the court to hold both that Burnett is sufficient, but that if it's not, that the error is harmless. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Can you address that last point first?
Remind me what it was, if you please.
It has to do with the testimony was harmless because it was cumulative, the other witnesses had testified the same way that Mr. Behar was going to testify, and the offer of proof did not say anything different.
Well, I think she's trying to have it both ways. I mean, either the court relied on the lack of a board mandate in some of its balancing of the factors, or it didn't.
Well, no, the question is, what was this witness going to testify to? Was it cumulative?
Mr. Behar, as I understand, the offer of proof was going to testify that it was that Alexa had to move to California or she was going to lose her position, and that is what the board required.
So, and that what is the difference between him and the prior witness?
He was not a family member. He was not part of the original team.
So he's a board member, but not a family member.
Correct. That's my understanding of it. And again, it seemed to me not only did this weigh into the court's analysis of her good faith reason, but it seemed to permeate a couple of the other factors that escape me at the moment. But again, the court cited that lack right itself, so I think it's hard to argue that it didn't weigh in its decision.
Counsel, do you believe that the court did not accept the necessity of your client to move to California, and whether it's board mandate or business requirements?
I think the court did not. Over and over again, as the court reviewed these factors, you see it, we called it fighting the facts in law school, kept saying, well, you can keep commuting. You can keep commuting. Even the factors that don't really apply to that, like can dad relocate or what are the alternative arrangements, the court says, well, she can keep commuting. The alternative always that mom keep doing what she had done and found no longer tenable given the increased size of her business. So, yeah, I absolutely think the court did that. I wanted to make a couple of quick points.
Are you going to address the agreement?
Yeah, I will address the agreement.
The argument is that she violated the agreement, and that
right.
should be held against her. So what's your response?
Yeah, let me back up just a little bit and remind, restate the importance, I think, that the detriment framing has here. We're looking for some kind of harm. We're not looking for something that's not optimal. And that's what the court and the parenting evaluator repeatedly referred to, is this attunement, this alignment, this narrative. That's not detriment by any stretch of not only imagination, but what we see in our case law. And the argument that the speculative effects that might happen down the road if this goes into effect is likewise not helpful or not doesn't really carry any weight. And it's belied by the facts of this family, where the father had been on the margins during the marriage.
Well, what about
and then has a strong bond?
What about Dr. Wheeler's criticism that the narrative related to the dad's bad parenting had escalated?
I don't remember the timing of that particularly. What the testimony was, the facts were, not her opinion about it, was that the kids noticed differences in the parents' home. And, of course, Dad had just remarried. There was a new blended family. The kids noticed differences. Kids do pick up on differences in family parents' styles, right? So I didn't see, and, in fact, most of the testimony that Dad brought in about this, whatever you want to call it, criticisms that he claimed Alexa made was pre-divorce. So I think all of those other witnesses were, and those that the parenting evaluator testified were pre-divorce. But let me get back to your question. I was trying to work my way to about the agreement.
You may answer.
May answer that. Thank you, sir. These parties' plan originally was to remain married, right? And then their plan was to raise their children in the heart of Seattle. Those plans changed, and the law does not hold them. It's not kind of strict or specific performance of those plans. Both of their realities changed. The law says, okay, how are we going to deal with that reality? And the structure they give us here is a presumption that the relocating parent has made a decision that is in the child's best interest, that's entitled to deference, and that the only thing that overcomes that is the showing of detriment.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.